This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing, and signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. We're 14 weeks removed now from Governor John Bel Edwards' stay-at-home order on the 16th day of March, and we are now seeing a spike in coronavirus cases, particularly in the LSU area and in 20 states, reaching all-time highs despite all that's happened over the course of the last 3.5 months. And we'll see what happens. We're 75 days away from the presumed start of the LSU football season. And, of course, if you have anything on that front that you'd like to discuss, we always welcome your input, and we will be discussing this. It is the searing issue of our time right now, this pandemic, which is afflicting life and the economy and the world as we know it. But also, amid all this, we have terrible unrest in our cities. We have a presidential election that is about 19 weeks away, 19 weeks from tomorrow to be precise. Donald John Trump spoke in Tulsa. The Wall Street Journal, the editor Alex Martin, was with us Friday, and we thought there would be, based on the Wall Street Journal reporting and others, as many as 100,000 people in Tulsa to greet the president. Turns out there were 6,000 people in Tulsa to greet President Trump. And the president, of course, made some remarks that gained headlines, as he always does. And we'll see what happens as we roll down the home stretch of a presidential election year, which promises to be vitriolic and combative between two septuagenarian candidates, 74-year-old Donald Trump and 77-year-old Joe Biden. But amid all this, we've had this terrible outbreak of violence in our cities, and this is a case in which police officers have killed unarmed black citizens. In one case, a man did have a taser, but he was shot in the back as he was running away from police officers in Atlanta. But it was 4 weeks ago today that George Floyd lost his life as his neck was compressed by the knee of a police officer, Derek Chauvin. And as a result, we've had an outpouring of concern, and most Americans, based on polls, now support the Black Lives Matter movement. And this came to a head in our great state over the last few days. In New Orleans a week ago, the statue of John McDonough was thrown in the Mississippi River. And Friday, the LSU Board of Supervisors voted to remove the name of General Troy Middleton, a bona fide American hero, from the LSU library because he was a segregationist who opposed integrating athletic teams at LSU in the year of 1961. And with us to talk about this is one of the best reporters in America, Jason Berry, one of the great investigative journalists of his time or any time. And he is here to talk about this because he wrote City of a Million Dreams. And this was in sync with Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, deciding to move 4 Confederate-era statues from the public square in the Crescent City. And this spurred a movement across this country in which statues, monuments were removed and are still being removed. And the latest, by the way, is one of none other than Teddy Roosevelt. The bronze statue of Theodore Roosevelt on horseback and flanked by a Native American man, an African man, which has presided over the entrance to the American Museum of Natural History in New York since 1940, is coming down. For many, the equestrian statue at the museum's Central Park West entrance has come to symbolize a painful legacy of colonial expansion and racial discrimination. Jason Berry, where does it stop? Is this the beginning, or is this the end, or is it somewhere in the middle?
God, excuse me, I don't mean to laugh at the topic. It's the question that rather bedevils me. So let me see if I can give you a reasonably intelligent answer. First, Jim, though, a slight point of clarification. The book I wrote, published in 2018, City of a Million Dreams, History of New Orleans at Year 300, does include a section on the dismantling of the statues, but the book covers 300 years of New Orleans history, and as a tricentennial history, was published that year, it really did not have a great deal to do with what Landrieu did. He did that all on his own, although I do treat that in the book. My guess, to your question is that we are just entering a new phase in America where these issues of historical memory that have long been shunted to the margins are now fusing with an incredibly contentious presidential campaign. And I think a lot of it has been brought on by Donald Trump's idea of making America great again, and particularly building the wall, in Texas and Arizona to try to keep people out. If you stand back and think about what these various protests of statues to the Confederacy in New Orleans, we have a big debate going over the names of certain streets named for slaveholders. And, you know, just the other day in San Francisco, the statue was pulled down of Father Serra, the Franciscan, who founded the missions to California. And now, by the lights of many people on the left, is a symbol of, you know, imperialism. We're going through an era where the myth of endless space that has so defined America, the idea that we are a country of endless frontiers, has ended, and in a sense, we're closing in on ourselves. We are the country that once put men on the moon, and right now we're engaged in these extraordinary debates over the meaning of America. Is it the America of Washington? Yes, he owned slaves. Is it the America of Martin Luther King Jr. and George Washington? I think it's questions that are defining this moment more than anything else, and Black Lives Matter is driving those questions at this time.
Well, what about Andrew Jackson? For those of us who were born in New Orleans, you and I, that's part of our history, Jackson Square. But he also held slaves, and he was a great American in warfare, hero of Battle of New Orleans, seventh American president, but he held slaves. Does that trump everything?
I'm not a polemicist, and I am not carrying an agenda in this. As a writer, I'm trying to understand it. My take on Jackson goes something like this. He was indeed a slaveholder, and his policies toward the Native Americans were brutal and violent. And in some respects, I don't know if reeked of genocide is too strong, but certainly the way in which America's Western expansion and Southern expansion moved had to do with the enslavement of Africans and clearing out of Indians. And that is objectionable to people who are descendants of people who were enslaved or people who were displaced. The statue, to me, stands for something that goes beyond who Jackson later became as president. When the general led the fight, the British, and both his British adversaries and Jackson, had no idea that the War of 1812 had ended. The Treaty of Ghent had been signed, but, you know, the British had burned Washington, D.C. in trying to retake America. The word about that treaty had not reached the battlefront at Chalmette, and so this major battle was fought with a kind of ragtag army that Jackson mustered, which included slaves or enslaved Africans and Creole African Americans. It certainly included volunteers, backwoodsmen, highly professional soldiers, and others. And if you ask yourself, well, had the British won, what would have become of New Orleans? I don't think they would have burned it. It wouldn't have been in their self-interest. But we would have had overlords at that time in the city who were themselves or had a history of being deeply engaged in the slave trade. You know, when Bienville founded New Orleans, the British were in league with Chickasaw Indians who were taking slaves of the Choctaw and other Native Americans. Slavery drenches not just the history of Louisiana and the South, but there is now substantial historical scholarship on the way in which Indians in the far West were enslaved by Spaniards and others in the great expansion of the country. So the questions being raised now have to do with our national identity.
All right, we do have to take a break, but we will continue with the remarkable Jason Berry. Your number is 877-217-5757. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org, and we're back in 90 seconds with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Jason Berry is with us, the remarkable reporter and writer. His latest work, City of a Million Dreams, covered New Orleans' 300-year history, and it culminated with the removal of the monuments by one Mitch Landrieu. It came as an order of the mayor, of course, was approved by the city council, but Mayor Landrieu is the one who made this happen. And a listener, it's Stan in Shreveport, listening online, asked the question as to whether Mitch Landrieu had any idea what was going to happen when these statues came down in the year of 2017. The Liberty Monument was long overdue. There was very little controversy about that. It should have been gone a long time ago. But then there were the statues of Robert E. Lee. Also, Beauregard, he came down. And Jason Berry, did Mitch Landrieu have any idea what this would cause as far as a nationwide trend? Please pull him up, Matt.
Yeah, sorry we got cut off there for a moment. I doubt that Mayor Landrieu foresaw the chain of events that we're seeing now. He was reluctant at first to make the move. A group called Take 'em Down, Bring 'em Down, had been pushing for years to get a lot of these statues removed. But it was Wynton Marcellus who, when Landrieu asked him to be part of the tricentennial events, said, in essence, I'll do it, but why don't you take down Robert E. Lee? And at the time, as Landrieu later recounted, he had no idea what he was talking about. I think his first response was, people go to Lee Circle to watch Mardi Gras parades. But as that dialogue deepened and the mayor started to do research on how the statues went up, he eventually came to his position that he had the legal authority to take them down, or at least the city did. There was, of course, about 2 years of legal delays because of different groups challenging that authority. But in the end, even the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal, a very conservative appellate court today, sided with the city, and the statues came down.
And I mentioned the Liberty Monument and Beauregard and Lee, but also there was a statue of Jefferson Davis, the only president of the Confederacy, mounted on a pedestal in the mid-city area, and it came down as well. Sade at LSU. Sade, you are on with Jason Berry. Good morning.
Hi, yes. My name is Shade, like under a tree.
Okay.
But anyway.
I'm Matt. Please put that extra consonant in there when you give me the information. Go ahead, Shade.
No worries. But I would just like to ask, and maybe it was just a slip of the tongue, but it seemed like Mr. Berry said something along the lines of that the descendants of enslaved people and Native and Indigenous people were the people that should be or that are currently upset about these statues. But I'm wondering why the descendants of the slaveholders, like myself, shouldn't also be very upset with these statues. And that it shouldn't be something that's glorified.
Well, Shade, we lost Shade. But Friday, they took the name of General Middleton off the LSU library, and he had advocated segregation as late as 1961. And before we get to what's happening at the Old War School, what about her point that those who are descendants of slaveholders are also ashamed of what happened in that time?
Well, I think Shade has a very good question, and as a candid response, and she did direct it to me, I would say that I share a measure of that shame. My great-great-grandfather in Georgia owned a plantation and had slaves. But beyond any personal sense of atonement, I think up until perhaps the young lady's own generation, within the last, say, 15 or 20 years, the idea that was so pervasive across the South of the lost cause, that, you know, the South fought the Civil War in honor, I mean, Gone with the Wind is the movie that was really the great myth maker. And it was a myth, a very sick myth, that, you know, the South had not fought to preserve slavery, but to preserve honor and tradition and all this business. One thing I would say, though, again in reference to her question, is that the opinion polls are pretty striking. Some 64% of Americans, at least the last time I checked, are in support of the protests. And, of course, the protests are not just about, you know, the police violence, but about the idea of symbols. And so I think there is a major shift going on in public thinking. And part of it, in my view, has to do not just with Southerners rethinking the meaning of the past here, but people generally looking at what Donald Trump has been thundering about for years. Make America great again. Bring us back to where we were. He doesn't want to remove any Confederate statues or names from Army bases when, in fact, the South seceded. Jefferson Davis spent 2 years in jail. So, you know, this is a very painful reckoning for many people, but I think it's one we need to have. And she had a good question, too.
Well, and General Middleton was not involved with the Civil War, the Confederacy. He fought for the United States in two wars and served more hours in combat than any U.S. general in the history of our country. He's gone from the public square at LSU. And that brings me to yesterday I was taking a walk, and outside the LSU Law Center is a beautiful statue of U.S. Senator Russell Long, graduate of the LSU Law School, class of 1942. Well, the same Russell Long signed the Southern Manifesto in 1956, which was in opposition to racial integration in public places. It accused the Supreme Court of clear abuse of judicial power, promised to use all lawful means to bring about a reversal of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. The same Russell Long in 1964 was among a Southern bloc of 18 Democratic senators that launched a filibuster to prevent the Civil Rights Act of 1964 from passing. There were Southern senators who voted on the right side of history: Albert Gore Sr., Estes Kefauver, and Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1956 all refused to sign the Southern Manifesto, but Russell Long and Allen Ellender of Louisiana gladly signed it. Does Russell Long have to go from LSU? Does the statue outside the library have to be removed based on the Middleton standard, Jason Berry?
Well, as I said earlier, I am not a protester. I am a writer, and I am trying to understand this moment, these convulsions as they sweep the country. Russell Long is a tough case for the reasons you just outlined, the same reason why Andrew Jackson is a tough case. My take on Jackson is that the statue is there because he saved the city, and the city would not be what it is today had he not done so. I'll give you another example. The Treme neighborhood in New Orleans, which is now famous for its music and the HBO series, is named for Claude Treme, who was a slaveholder who did a stretch in prison for killing a slave. But if you ask most people from Treme, what does the name mean? Well, it's the name of our neighborhood. It's who we are. It's our music. It's our culture. So names can change. I don't know. I guess the question with Russell Long is, did the good work he did after being a recalcitrant Southerner outweigh what he did? You know, it's like they're two parts of his life.
Can't the same be said for General Middleton?
I don't know a great deal about Middleton, frankly. I heard something on NPR yesterday that was fascinating. The guy who owned the Minnesota Twins for many years had his statue taken down. He's deceased now.
Calvin Griffin.
And, yeah. And the reason was, I mean, he was an out-and-out. He was not only a segregationist, he was a white supremacist.
All right, we're going to spend some more time with Jason Berry after this pause for the news. This is Jim Engster, Matt Doyle producing. You're listening to Talk Louisiana in another segment with Jason Berry, the fabulous writer in New Orleans. And his book is the definitive work about the 300 years, the three centuries of the Crescent City, City of a Million Dreams. We have a full board of calls right now, but if you be patient, you should be able to get in at 877-217-5757. We always invite emails at talk@talklouisiana.org. 2:30 today, the governor is going to make an announcement, and Talk Louisiana has been informed that the governor is not inclined to go to Phase 3 at this point, but he will make the official announcement today. But obviously things are changing in a bad way, as it has been noted. 30 LSU football players, not 30, have tested positive, according to Sports Illustrated, for COVID-19. Dan downtown, I believe. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, good morning. Mr. Berry, in assessing the legacy of Andrew Jackson, should we factor that he also was prejudiced against the British, not just because of the Battle of New Orleans, but because of a physical attack he suffered as a boy at the hands of a British soldier, leaving a permanent scar?
Yes, I'm quite aware of that, and I note that in the book. I don't know if prejudice against the British, Dan, is – it's a verb we might have a round of discussion about. He obviously did not like the British. Some speculate that he hated the British. But he was a man on fire who was absolutely determined not to let the British Army take New Orleans. And as you say, he had his personal reasons for that.
All right. Bill Huey writes, in 2016, Princeton's board voted to keep Woodrow Wilson's name on its programs and buildings despite a student sit-in to protest racial injustice. And so there's an example. Now, that was 4 years ago. Things may change. Thomas Wright says, when discussions of slavery are had, it is rarely mentioned how many people of color owned slaves. Well, does that make it right? No. Bianca London says, please make the distinction between systematically denying family ties, education, and a path to freedom from slavery, as was the case for African Americans, versus the type of slavery practiced by Native Americans.
Well, I'm not an authority on Native American slavery. I have just begun, in fact, reading about the history of the Far West and how it was done there. But she makes an extremely cogent point. You know, so much of what this raging national debate is about today goes far beyond slavery and has to do with the long march from Reconstruction through the end of the Second World War, when so many African Americans who migrated from the South to the industrial North found themselves redlined, unable to get loans in neighborhoods where they wanted, to buy houses. And the economic discrimination that followed, which has been exceptionally well documented by historians in recent years, is another factor in this. You know, I think what is looming, if you will, behind this burning summer of discontent is, you know, the whole discussion about reparations. which seems to go back and forth without any resolution. I don't know whether the country will be more poised in a unified sense to consider major programs for the cities, to schools, to try to do as Lyndon Johnson did in the Great Society for the betterment of society as a whole, or whether we're going to be stuck in the polarization, you know, between the Tea Party and the hard right fighting everything that a given president wants to do, as they did when Obama was in his second term.
Now, another listener notes that all men and women should be judged by the actions of their time, and it's a good point that Bill Clinton in 1993 paid a great political cost for the Don't Ask, Don't Tell measure, which now, 27 years later, would be viewed as racist. But at the time, it was viewed as being progressive, and he used a lot of political green stamps in doing this. So history can change in the blink of an eye, Jason.
Well, the perception of the past is what changes. You know, I look at Clinton today and the fact that he caved in on the Glass-Steagall Act, which, you know, was revoked under his term and gave Wall Street the runaway power without regulation that led to the, you know, 2008 collapse. He was an expedient politician. I don't say he didn't, you know, that there were not good things he did for the country. NAFTA, I think, is getting a hard second look by a good many historians. You know, when you're living in a moment of time when so many people are clamoring to change a country, and at the center of that clamor is the idea of national identity. Who are we as Americans? Are we, in fact, a social mosaic guided by the better angels of our nature, to quote Lincoln? Or are we fighting over a history that we can't even agree upon? I mean, one of the things that's been so striking to me is, Jim, do you know anywhere in the Deep South where we can find a statue of Abraham Lincoln?
No, and in Baton Rouge, we have several streets near LSU named after presidents. You go to right down the list, we got Buchanan, number 15, but no Abe Lincoln. Number 16 is conventionally, well, he's I think we know why he's not there. Lincoln has been removed. The first president of LSU was William Tecumseh Sherman.
Sherman.
The president of the Union Army, or the leader of the Union Army, and he's not. There's no building at LSU honoring General Sherman.
No, we take our symbols and our names quite seriously in the South, and I think you know, we have to come to terms with the past. We have to learn from it, because if we continue to deny it and allow ourselves to be swept away by these ideas of innocence. Well, I don't own slaves, and no one's had a slave, you know, in the South for over 150 years. That doesn't change the political dynamics of systemic repression.
David in Atlanta. David, you're on Talk Louisiana with Jason Berry. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. In 1954... Robert E. Lee Boulevard in New Orleans was named Hibernia Parkway, but the racist city fathers in New Orleans renamed it Robert E. Lee Boulevard as a protest and a statement of white supremacy protesting Brown versus Board of Education. And Mr. Barrett, if I may, what heavily contributed to the mortgage crisis, and you're correct in what you were saying, but also the Community Economic Development Act did not apply to non-bank institutions like Countrywide Credit. Countrywide Credit was making liar loans, no doc loans, to anybody who had a body temperature, and they sold those toxic mortgages
okay.
to Wall Street.
All right, and Wall Street, by the way, the Dow went up 229% in the 8 years of William Jefferson Clinton, more than any other U.S. president, and he erased the deficit and left with a surplus, and we now have a deficit that will be about $4 trillion this year. So on the whole, I think, Jason, President Clinton was a good president. But getting back to Robert E. Lee, I grew up in New Orleans. I was born in 1958, lived there the first 9 years of my life, not far from Robert E. Lee Boulevard. I didn't know that the name had not been changed until 1954.
Well, it's now part of the debate the city council is having, and your caller from Atlanta was, dead on the mark in what he said. You know, I keep coming back to the point that we need to have this national reckoning. It has been long overdue. And the fact that people are wrestling with questions about what the country is, what we stand for, and where we should be going. This is democracy. It's messy.
Patrick in Ennis-Walda States. Patrick, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Well, I just want to make a quick point, and that is the 1860 census that was taken showed that more free blacks chose to live in the slave states than in the North.
All right. Well, come on, Patrick. You can do better than that. If they were born in slave states, then most likely they were going to stay. And by the way, we didn't have air travel and cars in 1860 either. But anyway, thank you. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. Phil, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. You know, there was this history of genocide that happened under Columbus and his the island of Hispaniola. A tribe of 100,000 people were murdered, and we wouldn't know about that if it weren't for the priest Bartholomew who recorded that.
All right. What about Chris Columbus? He's now under fire, too. I think he's been removed from the public square in Columbus, Ohio. So, Jason?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were speaking to the gentleman who just called. I don't mean to sound redundant or as a perpetual optimist. My wife would dispute that. But I am heartened by the national conversation we are having.
Mike in Lafayette. Mike, good morning. Please be brief. You're on with Jason.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
The statues that I think Black Lives Matter is more concerned with is the ones that went up during the 1920s and also in the 1960s as a slap in the face. This is when the Confederate monuments went up to glorify the Confederacy. And most of it was done by the Daughters of the Confederacy.
All right. To preserve the lost cause. We'll be back to wrap it up with Jason Berry. And also we'll hear from Fairleigh Jackson of Preserve Louisiana after this quick timeout.